Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. Well, almost every Tuesday. We've had a studio fire and been off quite a few weeks. Online at bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Professor Peter M. Phillips from Sonoma State University in California, author of Giants of the Global Power Elite. The book, also a website, and one of the main project managers for that, called Project Censored. It's been going for many years. He introduces us to the unofficial rulers of the planet, that is the Executive Committee of Global Capitalism. And David Livingstone, author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. He runs a website, conspiracyschool.com, and he's had a close look at the beliefs of the convicted child sex offender and child trafficker who's recently committed suicide in the United States, Jeffrey Epstein. So tonight we get to know who the elite are and what they believe, hopefully. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name's Peter Phillips. I'm a professor of political sociology at Sonoma State University. I have specialized for years in studying elites, and initially the power elite in the United States, and now more of a transnational elite in the world. I have a strong background in media studies, and I was director of Project Censored at Sonoma State for 14 years and did annual yearbooks on news stories not covered by the corporate media.
Can you just tell us something about Project Censored?
Project Censored was founded in 1967, as a media research group by Dr. Carl Jensen, and it did an annual release of the most important news stories that were not covered by the corporate media. So we're now going on 50 years, and it's the director is Mickey Huff at Diablo Valley College. There's about 20 universities in the U.S. and Canada that participate. And we still put out a book every year entitled Censored, The News That Didn't Make the News.
So do the FBI or the CIA control Project Censored now? Because I know they do control similar sorts of organizations in Britain, like, for example, Index on Censorship.
We're completely independent. We're a nonprofit corporation.
That's what they say here in London. The thing is that the intelligence services and the corporate elite spend quite a lot of time and effort in infiltrating these sorts of organisations. So I'm under how sure you are that Project Censored hasn't fallen to their influence.
100% sure. I mean, it's really just a few dozen people, and we've been working together for years. So could there be people who have infiltrated or think about, yeah, but they have no zero control over what we do.
Okay. Well, that's excellent to hear. Anyway, you picked up on this expression, the power elite, really, which was, I think I'm right in saying, coined in the 1950s by C. Wright Mills. Could you say something about that book, The Power Elite? Because it's not all that well known outside sociology and university circles, but he was quite a colorful character, wasn't he?
Yeah, C. Wright Mills was at Columbia. He was a sociologist, and he was writing about elites and the powerful most of his life. Book came out in 1956 called The Power Elite, and he was hypothesizing at the time that there are higher circles and networks of powerful people based in corporations, government, and the military, and this was, of course, right after World War II, who are the dominant policymakers, decision makers in the country. And so he basically said the power elite are those people who make the decisions about what's important.
And this is one of the reasons why it's so important to keep an eye on the whole revolving door syndrome between the military and government, between the government and the big corporations.
Oh, absolutely. He was talking about that. Of course, then Eisenhower, a few years after that, warned about the, you know, the military-industrial complex and the power that it was having. And then, of course, we see how that power, that evolution, has manifested itself today. But it was a real coup. I mean, getting rid of the Kennedys, assassinating, you know, the Kennedys was an achievement that that power elite group needed to occur, because the Kennedys were challenging the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, and other elite pro-military groups in the country. So they needed to go.
What about today? Who would you say are the most powerful people in the world? Are they from the US or other places? Because it's really not just about wealth, is it? It's also about how organized that power is in order to affect change.
Exactly. Giants, the Global Power Elite, is my book. And we focus on the giant investment companies like BlackRock, Vanguard, JP Morgan Chase, Allianz in Germany, UBS in Switzerland. These are the companies that control over $1 trillion of investment capital. So they take the billionaires and the millionaires, their money, and they will find places to put it to give them a return. So there's 17 companies that were giants of over $1 trillion, and that was in 2017. There's a couple more that have grown into that. At that time, they controlled $41 trillion. It's closer to $50 trillion today. And there's only about 200 people that manage those, 17 companies. So you've got 199 people that are controlling $40 trillion, closer to $50 trillion now, of wealth in the world, which in terms of capital and free-floating wealth is a major part of the money in the world. And it's centralized. They're all invested in each other. It's not like they're competitors. There's over $400 billion of crossed investment, and that was just the NASDAQ money that we were able to identify in these 17 firms. So you have one giant cluster of interconnected capital controlled just by a few hundred people that is making decisions of where to invest in the world and what policies to be implemented. They are in turn supported by private policy elite groups, non-governmental, like the Atlantic Council, the Council of 30, and the Trilateral Commission. All are private. All are corporate-based. Private money based, and they're making policy recommendations that are implemented by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and governments and intelligence agencies.
I mean, it sounds to me like these people are so wealthy, they can just buy up politicians, buy up political parties in their tea break.
Absolutely. That's how it works. I mean, the West capital, the Western capital, is controlled, is money controlling governments and buying up, elections and candidates, particularly in the U.S., but also in Europe and elsewhere, dominate the political process, which they call democracy, which is just basically top-down control. And they will utilize the media, which they own, the ideologists, to present, viewpoints to try to convince the, working people that everything's okay.
Well, this is the hang best on, way Peter, because we've got lots of different media outlets right across the West, from BBC, CNN. BBC is actually a state broadcaster. So, I mean, there is some plurality, surely. I mean, they're not all singing from the same hymn sheet, are they?
The Western governments are dominated and working towards protecting this vast centralized global capital and capitalism. There are major media groups that are controlled and invested in by these giant corporate investment companies. So MSNBC, ABC, Fox, CNN, they're all have deep investments by these giants. So there's vested interests. And I have to say that even BBC is certainly pro-capital and invest and trying to protect global capital in everything that they do. So you can get a variety of news stories, but there's still themes that are strongly pro-capital investment and pro-capitalism.
What about the Bilderberg Group? Because you mentioned the Trilateral Commission, they're very similar. These are kind of shadowy group that I've been particularly following since 1995. And the thing that really rang alarm bells for me was finding that the chairman for the first 20 years of the group from 1956 to 1975 was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who before World War II, he was actually an SS officer. So the idea that this group was chaired by an SS officer for the first 20 years should make it newsworthy, but it doesn't seem to get much coverage. So who are the Bilderbergs and where do they feature in this global power elite that you've written about?
Well, the Bilderbergs are clearly primarily a European group, and have been meeting for 67 years, and the most recent meeting was in Montreux, Switzerland, the weekend of May 30th to June 2nd, and they had a number of the people that they invite are new each year. So in this year, from my group of global power elites, a CEO of AXA, Thomas Burrell from Germany, was in attendance. Mark Carney from Canada, governor and director of the Bank of England, was present. Roger Ferguson, CEO of TAII, which is a private investment management company, big hedge fund, was there. Thomas Lyssen from Belgium was there, KBC Bank, and Dijon Thiam from Ivory Coast was there. He's on the Credit Suisse. He's CEO there. Those five were members of the global power elite that are listed in my book. But of the people in my book, there's another 18. That have been to Bilderberg, so they may go 1 year, but then not go again. So there's a core group of people that are there every year, including some royalty in that. But they change. So like Rockefeller and Brzezinski were there in 1973. And they came back and they said, well, that was all cool, but we need to have something like that here in the U.S. So that's when they formed the Trilateral Commission. So the Bilderberg is a smaller version. They only have about 100 to 150 people that go on any given year. They go to different places. They meet once a year at elite resorts. And it's all off the record, private discussions about where we need to go to protect global capital and to continue to see growth and protect the West. I mean, that's what it's about. So they worry about the precariat. They worry about China and Russia. They worry about, some of the things on their agenda, economic stability, things like that. But they're not making policy. They're just coming to consensus and agreement among elites in the world, and they're one place where that happens. Davos is another. The Bohemian Grove is another place where there's intersections of high-level elites in private settings that discuss about the direction and policy they want to go. And then they go back to their various institutions and their policy networks and implement it.
Now, I mean, obviously they're getting quite a lot of interesting ideas feeding in. Policy you're talking about there. Effectively, you've got a cartel of like 200 people all working together. This is specifically Bilderberg we're talking about. But from a bigger perspective, I mean, you're also saying that they're reacting, they're protecting capitalism, but they're not just doing that, are they? They're also extending. I mean, Bilderberg is very closely connected with the war on terror. There's a lot of military people going. Petraeus, for example, is another one. And they seem to be quite proactive as well. But I mean, can we identify any specific individuals who you think are more powerful out of this sort of 200 people that are some of the most powerful in the world? Are there any sort of names that people might know who you could say are, well, these are the real kind of brains behind this elite?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the people that get the attention, like Jeff Bezos, as the richest person in the world, he's just one big tree in the forest. And he's not the network. In fact, we don't even list him in the Global Power League. Although he probably has a lot of, you know, some influence and power in his own right. But the elite networks are like a redwood forest. All of their roots are interconnected. So these global capitalists, the ones in the that are controlling centralized capital, this $50 trillion worth of wealth, which is over half of the free-floating capital in the world, have invested interests, not in each other, and making sure that capital can continue to grow and have and offer a return every year. So so in doing that, they'll invest in anything that gives them a return, whether it's Coca-Cola bottle, you know, puts out a billion, 100 million plastic bottles every year, single-use bottles that end up in the environment for 400 years. And they're floating in the ocean in giant quantities. Or it's military investment, where, you know, wars happen and profits are made by private war companies and war production companies, and allowed for that. The biggest problem that capital investment people have is finding they have more capital, they've got good places to put it. So wars and privatization of public domain, whether it's water or schools or public land, is being bought up and privatized worldwide. So that that's one way of using up capital. And, you know, they lost it in 2008, literally, by getting heavily engaged in the subprime mortgage business. They, you know, it took trillions of dollars of bailout money to keep that system afloat worldwide. Every capitalist country was putting money into their banks to make sure that they were stable. It was just trillions of dollars. And that, you know, they're worried about that possibly happening again.
But I mean, surely they can make money when something like that happens. When there's a bailout back in 2008. Actually, what happened was they got told, slap of the wrists, don't do it again. And by the way, here's £1 trillion or $1 trillion of public money, just carry on. And if it happens again, or if there's a real crash where the actual stock markets go through the floor, and people lose all their investments because, oh dear, sorry, you can't put your money in the bank. There's no interest to be made there. So you've got to go and speculate on the stock exchange if you've got savings these days. What we could be looking at is them actually... We're talking about the rich, the super elite, with a bit of insider knowledge, they could make a fortune. Like George Soros, people like this can use a crash to actually make a killing, quite literally.
Well, most of them lost money, but some came out better than others. There were collapses and mergers, so it was even this wealth was even more completely consolidated. So that BlackRock and Vanguard and J.P. Morgan Chase, they all came out of greater amounts of capital that they managed and have continued to grow and expand that capital net wealth. So that privatization process and the sorting through, we have seen now even greater wealth among the top 0.001% of the people.
I mean, to be
in the 1% of the world only requires $770,000 in assets. But if the person with $770,000 is small potatoes compared to the top 0.001% or the billionaires or the multi-billionaires, and even there's 36, you know, million millionaires in the world, many of them with 10 or 100 million, that wealth concentration is quite severe, even within the 1%.
Well, look, I take what you put your point about Jeff Bezos. He's not actually really in there. I mean, isn't it the fact that most of the people who are very, very powerful in control of this wealth don't really want to be known about at all? And they have their kind of minions and people who will go on to TV. These are the people we're supposed to see. But the really powerful people, these are the ones I want you to name now, are the ones who are behind the scenes.
Well, I would certainly say that the most central, most powerful group of people are the Council of 30, the G30, and they're based in Washington, D.C. They're executive. They have 32. There's 32 people, two women, and this is where you see they're the ones. Bernanke is there. Carney is there. People from Europe. William Dudley from Bank for International Settlements is there. Those 32 people are the Executive Committee of Global Capitalism. Roger Ferguson, Thomas Geithner, Jacob Finkel from U.S. Israel American International Group. Gail Kelly is one of the few women there. She's Australian and part of the Bankers Association Australia. Philip Hildebrand from Switzerland is chair, former chair of the Swiss National Bank, and now is chair of BlackRock in that. Paul Krugman is there as one of the world's economists. So these are the people in the top 30 of in what's called the Group of 30, former president of Mexico, the Chinese construction bank, Zhao Fuchun, is there. So they are a very centralized advisory group that puts out reports with private money that is seen as instructions for the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and literally governments where we should be going and intelligence agencies.
Amazing. What can we do about these people? I mean, particularly the ones you've mentioned there in the G30, these are mostly, I mean, one or two of the names we've heard of, but actually what can we do to sort of break the spell to actually get back control of money so that money starts to serve ordinary people rather than people becoming slaves to money?
Well, they believe that growing capitalism will trickle down and benefit the entire world. That simply isn't happening. 80% of the world lives on less than $10 a day. Half the world lives on $3 a day. So what's happening is this continued concentration of wealth in a very small number of people that is continuing to grow and at the expense and the harm to everyone else and to the environment and to war and to, you know, possible extinction of the human race. So we have to multiple things. I mean, there's resistance ongoing worldwide, the Bolivarian revolts, the workers' movements in China, the student movements in Italy and Spain, resistance in Greece. I mean, there's public resistance movements to all of this centralized capital worldwide, which is part of the reason they have NATO and the U.S. military empire as the police force globally to protect global capitalism. But it's inevitable. They can't continue to concentrate wealth and without eventual threat of collapse. Collapse because of capital collapse and or collapse because of the environment. Both are imminent threats to us in very real ways. And
well, it's also, of course, there's also war.
Write a letter.
There's also war too, to Peter. There's also potentially war too, because they're making lots of money. This is a dangerous game, isn't it? Making your trillions from war.
It's a very dangerous game, and war is always a possibility. And that danger, that possibility, inevitability of human catastrophic wars, environmental collapse, and civil unrest is going to happen unless they make change to share that wealth on a global scale. And that's what we're saying, that we want them to implement the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we're going to pressure them to do it. Social movements are pressuring them to do that. And by identifying who they are, that's what this book is about. Here are the 389 people who could do something about this.
But hang on, because these people are making money. If the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and implementing those rights, so-called rights, which are pretty much not legally enforceable in there, is going to dent their profits, then I'm afraid they're going to tear it up and throw it in the bin.
Then their grandchildren won't have grandchildren if they do that. And that's the message.
How can you persuade people who are just hell-bent on making money that, human rights are even important? And that's the trouble.
Some are very concerned about this. Some of the discussions at Bilderberg and other places are about the dangers of the environment. about the futures of war, about the refugees and the precariat, you know, the working class decline, middle class. So they're aware of this. Some are more aware of it than others and more concerned about it. And so the idea is to divide the elite into those who are willing to do something about it, encourage that politically and with social movement force, and hope that the goal is to have those kinds of changes occur before there's war and economic and environmental collapse that kills billions of people.
Well, it sounds like a laudable mission. But it sounds to me like what you're describing, Peter, is not really a democratic system at all. It sounds more medieval, almost feudal.
It's neo-feudalism is where we're at today, for sure. And it's neo-feudalism with a police state attached. And an increasing privatization of that police state. The largest, second largest private employer in the world is G4S, based in London, and employs 625,000 people worldwide as mercenaries and guards and protectors of wealth.
Now, you're speaking to us from California. You're speaking from the United States, which many countries around the world now see as the big problem. This whole thing of regime change seems to be causing massive problems, not just in the Middle East, but also now in places like Venezuela. Is there any hope for the United States to return to being a democracy? I think a lot of people are concerned that with someone like Trump in charge, and others, whoever succeeds him, we don't have the sort of statesmanship that we had from people like John F. Kennedy.
Well, Trump is just a manifestation of the global power elite. And any president, Obama, any of the presidents, are fully aware of the power of Wall Street and the power of global money. And they don't do anything to challenge that because they know what happened to the Kennedys. And so that's, you know, there was a coup in 1963, and that coup was continued. And anybody that challenges or looks like they could possibly challenge this capital system, their plane falls out of the sky or they're corrupted in some way. And that's ongoing. So it would be important to recognize the power that how this is being used. And that we have to massively, collectively challenge the systems that the way they exist today. So that's not going to be through electoral processes here in the U.S. It's not possible. And U.S. is of my global power elite. There's about 60% are U.S. citizens, and many have multiple nationalities, a number with Israel as well. But the rest of the world is capital as well. And so that's Europe, and that's Asia and Japan and Singapore, and to varying degrees, the Chinese. The difference with the Chinese is the Politburo is in charge there, and even if you're a billionaire, you don't have a whole lot of say in terms of the Communist Party. So it's a very strong centralized government system there that allows for capital growth and expansion and uses it and allows people to be rich, but they're still fairly independent from the Western capital. And in many areas, particularly in Africa, in competition. So that's an ongoing threat. There's efforts to try to bring Chinese capital into the fold, so to speak. BlackRock is just opening up an office in Beijing. And AXA, UBS have offices already in Shanghai and other places. And the government allows some investment, but it's at this point, it's insignificant. So the central bank, a banker from the central bank is from China is on the Council of 30. So they're part of the discussion, but they're certainly not the major part. And this capital concentration of 50 trillion managed by a few hundred people, is the center of the world power and capital today.
Okay, look, the $64,000 question, if I can put it like that, is that doesn't sound very much. The figures that you've been talking about there, is there any chance that the financial system will ever be serving humanity again?
Only, yes, if we really make it happen. And that's my goal of this book, is to identify those people who are in charge, and that we need to get in their face, so to speak. And that actually does work. Jamie Dimon, who was chair of J.P. Morgan Chase, activists have been targeting him at his home and on the Upper East Side, and picketing there over the issue of private, their investments in private prisons. And they got J.P. Morgan Chase to withdraw from investing in private prisons because they targeted him in his office. So he was willing to give up on private prison investment. And I go, well, okay, how about giving up on investing in Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Boeing? But that's not the issue at this point. But the issue is that we can identify them and pressure them to make decisions that are correct for humanity.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it, whether they're going to take some sort of cataclysm before these people wake up, Peter?
I certainly hope not. And, you know, that's why we have to identify who these people are. And so instead of just saying, oh, it's Bezos and it's Gates and it's, you know, it's not. The network is very clear, and that's, the book is about the global power elite as a sociological network.
I remember, this is from the 1990s, I think, some quote that was going around saying that the planet is not dying, it's being killed, and those killing it have names and addresses. And that's something that seems to have almost been forgotten.
We should not forget that.
Peter Phillips, author of Giants of the Global Power Elite, thank you very much for joining us. And I think you've picked up on a fantastic tradition, Peter. Well done. Started by C. Wright Mills in looking at these people.
Tony, thank you very much for having me on.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is David Livingston. I am an author, independent researcher. I've written several books. I operate a website called conspiracyschool.com, and I'm currently working on a new book. One of my books is called Transhumanism, the History of a Dangerous Idea, and I trace the long-term history of transhumanism as basically a modern outgrowth of the occult tradition and of chaos magic.
Okay, so your website, Conspiracy School, some will look at that and say, well, what you're trying to do is just fuel madness, fuel conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, I have to say the reverse argument. Why is conspiracy theory ridiculed? And it's pretty clear that that's, you know, ad hominem is the most cowardly way of participating in a debate. So when you've got nothing left, you throw insults. And so the way that they protect investigation of the truth is to denounce it as conspiracy theory.
But, I mean, that doesn't really count when it comes to things like the moon landings, chemtrails. There's quite a lot out there which almost seems to be crazy, you know. So how do you separate the real worthy investigations from the crazy stuff?
I mean, the thing is, you know, the truth, when you start digging into it, is pretty crazy anyway. So, you know, it's almost as outlandish as, you know, some of the other stuff that's out there. But it's just, you know, I think the average person has a sense that there's something else going on. I think most of them are intimidated into sharing that opinion because of the way that conspiracy theory is ridiculed. But it's a matter of looking at the data, and you know, like anything, you cross-check people's references and their evidence, and decide for yourself.
You're saying that transhumanism is somehow linked to the occult. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. So if you look at Nick Bostrom is one of the two founders of the transhumanist, what's it called, the modern transhumanist society, and he wrote a book called The History of Transhumanism, and he himself explicitly links it to the occult. So he basically says he traces transhumanism to things like alchemy, the Rosicrucians, and most importantly, he traces it to the history of the Golem, the Frankenstein, the story of Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. That's very important in itself. If you look at the Mary Shelley, her husband, Percy Shelley, their friendship with Lord Byron was a member of Carbonari. Her father was William Godwin, who was one of the founders of anarchism. His mother, radical feminist. You know, these are people who advanced some pretty radical ideas in their time. They're typically atheists. They were libertines. And deeply involved in the cult of Mary Shelley, so Percy Shelley was very interested in the occult, particularly alchemy and Rosicrucianism. And so that's where all this stuff comes from. And so, you know, the history of transhumanism is very much parallel to the history of the computer, and the history of the modern computer is the history of the attempt to create a modern-day Golem. And that is not my interpretation. That has been revealed by Norbert Wiener, who was the founder of cybernetics, which is basically the field that drove the development of the computer through the CIA, DARPA, and so on. And his book is titled God and Golem, Inc. And so he does it as well. He also basically, he also justifies their pursuit as being a sort of modern-day magic. And he explicitly compares the development of artificial intelligence and a thinking machine to the creation of a golem.
So what is a golem?
So golem is a living creature that is created through the use of what's called names of power. And it's a Kabbalistic, it's a form of practical magic that belongs to Kabbalah. I think it was originally mentioned in the Sefer Yetzirah, which is one of the most ancient Kabbalic texts. It's a legend that sort of makes its appearance first among the Ashkenazi Hasidim. Those are like that's really where Kabbalah takes its birth in Europe, which is in southern Germany. And in close relation with the Kabbalists of southern France. But the one who popularized the legend is a rabbi named Rabbi Lo, who lived in Prague, I believe, in the 1500s. And so he's the one who's famous. In fact, if you go to Prague and you visit the Jewish section of the city, there's all kinds of, you know, commemorative tourist pieces or information about his creation of the Golem. Lots of storybooks and so on about it. He's famous for having done that. In fact, if you look at in Jewish history, the Golem is claimed to have done various things for having, you know, rescued the Jewish people from persecution and all kinds of things like that.
Well, it's not often that you find transhumanism going into the national press, into the mainstream press, and being mentioned.
Right.
But it's happened, hasn't it, with the case of Jeffrey Epstein? Why do you think, or in what way do you think he was influenced by this? I suppose you could almost call it a religion. It's certainly a belief system, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a religion, but it's really just a new name for the same old thing. Yeah, I think it's because it's the same old thing that has been adapted to modern science, which is why it now has a new name. It's the same old interest of that's modified in ways that it couldn't have before because of what's available to modern science. I think it's important to look at Epstein in context as well, too. It seems pretty evident to me that he was probably a spy working for the Mossad and the blackmail operation for Mossad. He admitted himself that he worked for intelligence. And what's his name, Acosta, the judge that gave him his walk-away deal, he said himself recently that he wasn't able to touch Epstein because he was told that he was hands-off because he was apparently a intelligence asset. So you look at the bigger picture and you look at, I mean, his connections are so deep, it's almost mind-boggling. The people in his black book included John Kerry, Kissinger, Steve Forbes, Richard Branson, celebrities like Dustin Hoffman, Ralph Fiennes, Katie Couric, George Papadopoulos, Stephanopoulos, sorry. You know, and the list goes on and on and on and on. Like, you know, so many deep connections. So you've got to wonder what kind of world is he operating in. And so ultimately, I think, you know, if you look at the kind of people he participated, so that world basically also boarded into the a number of scientists, so people like Richard Dawkins and Stephen Hawking, Marvin Minsky. These are all the people who, you know, many of them were invited to his island for various discussions. So if you look at the pattern of Epstein's life, there's really three paths there that are parallel, and I think it's very much indicative of the sort of culture that these guys come from. So the one is financial. So, I mean, or first you can start with physics. So his first interest was in physics. Secondly, he ended up in finance. And then thirdly, his extracurricular activities, when I say sexual activities. So I do, those are not to be interpreted as being independent. They're all part of some kind. I mean, we can only speculate of what he's really coming from. But understanding the occult as an outside person, from what I've seen from my investigation, those are three paths that are commonly associated. So, you know, the physics is basically often verges into an area of pseudoscience, you know, as like alchemy has always been, and magic is basically always been a kind of pseudoscience. And then, finance, of course, is a way for them to maintain, achieve wealth, sustain a degree of authority and power. And then ultimately, they are often Luciferians, or they are nihilists, and that nihilism or Gnosticism is expressed in a kind of libertinism, which regards, like Freud said, basically that, you know, sex is our basic drive and instinct.
I mean, you're parceling three things again together there: nihilism, narcissism, and Luciferianism. Can you just explain why you mentioned them kind of almost in the same breath? I mean, that sounds to me as if you're parceling a little bit too much in the same place. Can you just explain why you talk about those three together? What the links are, if you believe there are?
Well, it's the same thing. So, I mean, if you like, Gnosticism is very much the origin of all this stuff, right? So, Gnosticism reads the Bible in reverse. And so that God is actually evil, and he enforced a number of laws which only restrict us, but basically repress our instincts, our natural instincts. So Gnosticism basically seeks to liberate the human being by allowing him to indulge in any fantasy, whim, or perversion that he chooses. And so... The Lucifer is the liberator. He's the one who frees man from the oppression of God, but he's also, he teaches man the science of the universe so that he can himself become God. So that's why, you know, if you look at most of the leading science in Western history have tended to be occultists. There are Roger Bacon, Francis Bacon, Newton, you know, and very much in Western history, it's alchemy, even in Islamic history as well, too. It's alchemy that really much gave birth to modern science. The modern science is basically born from magic.
Okay, so how does that fit in with nihilism then?
Because nihilism is nihilism. So, you know, like I often say, nihilism is Luciferianism, and Luciferianism is nihilism. So it's Luciferian, you know, that's why nihilism, you find nihilism all over the world, but it's not always branded as Luciferianism. But nihilism is an open tendency for human beings. It's basically just a rejection. It's a rejection of the possibility of meaning in the universe, and so by that, it naturally leads into a rejection into the possibility of good, the possibility of caring, the possibility of anything mattering. So that's why nihilism typically leads into licentiousness, or and do what thou wilt, and that's why you'll find a kind of Gnosticism everywhere around the world, because you know even again a guy living in a cave, he could still become a nihilist and achieve the same conclusions that the Gnostics do. It just comes with a whole lot of less baggage and vocabulary.
So the idea is that nothing really matters. You just do whatever you want. And actually, you can pretend, you can lie, so long as the... Right. I mean, this sounds a little bit like the philosophy of the end justifies the means.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it is. And that's why it leads to social Darwinism. And so social Darwinism is a fancy name associated with a particular person, but it's social Darwinism, you're going to find, you know, going back centuries to the earliest cavemen who were the first to question his obligation to his fellow man.
Now, one of the people who was a victim of Jeffrey Epstein, Virginia Roberts, has come out over the last week or so and explained that there was some kind of a human breeding farm that right. Epstein wanted to create. And in fact, he was trying to recruit her and offered her, I think it's $200,000 a month to basically be one of his human breeders. How does that fit in with the wider transhumanist ideas?
Well, transhumanism is eugenics. Right? So if you look at the history of eugenics, it's central to the activities of these, you know, quote-unquote conspirators in the 20th century. And eugenics begins with the social Darwinists. And that's long before the Nazis came along. The problem is, In their mind, is the Nazis just gave it a bad word, so they're trying to resurrect it in different guise, and that's pretty much what transhumanism is.
So, I mean, is this considered by transhumanists normal that you would have a load of females in a kind of breeding farm?
That I don't know. I'm not surprised that they would think that way, because that's where they're inclined to. But as far as their specific agenda, I think, you know, they probably keep that kind of stuff secret. You know, I mean, the common thing with transhumanism is cryogenics. You know, that's more of the popular manifestation of it, as far as breeding programs and stuff like that. And I'm not surprised those things exist, but I don't have any record of it.
Okay, there's also been a couple of interesting developments with Prince Andrew, who's obviously still friendly with Epstein, even after he was a convicted paedophile. And we've also heard about Catherine Keating, the daughter of Paul Keating, the Australian Prime Minister, who was actually, as his daughter, was a New South Wales government advisor, being associated with, this is with Epstein after his conviction. Now, you know, this does make it sound as if he's got some very, very close links to the real, very, very top of power, both in Australia and here in Britain. I mean, what does that signify? What do you read into those connections, even after the guy's been, convicted of paedophilia?
Well, the thing is, you know, we talked about conspiracy theory in the beginning, and the thing is, all this stuff takes place in secret, and we're forced to operate mostly on circumstantial evidence. And then we kind of have to construct a model to explain, you know, what does that circumstantial evidence say? But the thing is that there's just so much of it that it really starts to build a pretty solid picture. It's just that we don't have firm confirmation of it because we don't have any confessions. So when you see how he operates and what kind of circles he operates in, it really makes you start to wonder, you know, what kind of beliefs do these people have and how are they shared and how many of them share them? You know, and, you know, like I was looking at the group around like Richard Dawkins and the people around him who are associated with Epstein and the kind of values and agenda that they have. You know, they basically what they call this reality club, which is basically a club of atheists. And, you know, so, yeah, I don't know. There's just, I don't have any proof. And that's the thing. I think that's what's happening is I see a lot of people coming up with some pretty outlandish speculations about, you know, they're looking at the temple on his island and they're extrapolating about what it could possibly mean. The thing is, we don't have any evidence about that stuff. But there's a lot of stuff that we do have some very solid evidence about. And, you know, it's not enough to construct a solid picture, but it starts to give us some hints about what it seems to be happening around it. Like, I think, you know, one particular interesting documentary, it's pretty rare for these things to be properly exposed, but there's a documentary, it's available on YouTube called Dutch Injustice, and it's about the pedophile rings in Holland that have been exposed right to the very top. So when you see that happening there, you know, we can kind of imagine what's probably happening in England.
You know? I mean, are you surprised to see this very close link to the British royal family?
Well, you know what? It's interesting. What you want to investigate is not far away from Epstein's island and also another island where Trump wants to create some kind of resort. There's a very mysterious island called Mustique. So I recommend you look that up. That's an island that was visited by the young Prince William, Kate Middleton.
Kate Middleton.
Can't remember their names now. Yeah, and so they visit that island. It's an island that goes back to Princess Margaret was hanging around there, and all kinds of people. And it's the same. It's this parallel thing. It's also tied to the Profumo scandal. So there's another blogger who's kind of drawn some connections between the Epstein scandal and the Profumo scandal. Like, again, that reveals, you know, the depth of these hidden activities that seem to be happening under our noses.
Were you surprised that Epstein committed suicide?
You know, what's tragic is that the lawyer for the accusers had only mentioned a couple of weeks before that Epstein was in danger and that no matter where they kept him, even if they kept him in isolation, that there was people who wanted him to keep his mouth shut that are powerful enough to get to him wherever he would be kept. And so that's proven to be true.
David Livingston, thanks very much for joining us. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast, if you like, at our website, dialectsradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Professor Peter M. Phillips, author of Giants of the Global Power Elite, and the website Project Censored. Also, David Livingston, the website conspiracyschool.com, and the book Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. Thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
needs. Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night, blinded by the light. Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night.
Stone. another runner in the night, blinded by the light. Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night, blinded by the light. Wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night,
in the dark with the monsters, the eyes.
Never got touch, it's gonna make it through.